Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, let's hit the ground running because time is short.
Time is of the essence.
I'm at the historic Shepherd's Bush Empire. I'm here with Dennis from Refuse. They're playing here tonight with Thrice. I want to ask you about the damn show at the London Palladium the other night, first
yes,
of all.
Please.
I saw a picture of you there. Am I right in thinking that you have a friendship with Dave?
No.
No.
But I wish I had.
He's a cool cat, right?
He seems like a cool cat.
Yeah?
They're one of my favorite bands, like... Also one of the favorite bands because I feel like the kinship with the band that started out one way and ended up somewhere else, and like it's all been solid. So it was a great night. We did like one of those secret like K-Pit session shows.
At Blondie's. So I used to live in a flat directly behind that bar.
That
and
is
I remember
awesome.
the girl, was that the Blondie, the girl there?
Yeah.
She opened it and she was like, I've got all these big plans for this place. And I was like, because the street that it's on is pretty rough and ready.
Yeah.
And I think in the last 2 years, she's just taken this idea and it's morphed into this beautiful thing.
It was great. So we did that show and then I rushed off and I saw the second.
That's what I'm going to do. I'll just spin you around like that.
All right. The second half of that Night of a Thousand Vampires shindig, and then we went to an after party and I got introduced, and because we're on the same management as
Raw
the
Power.
Damned, yeah,
yep.
So I got introduced and we took a photo, and it was people, you know how it is, like people were surrounding him, I'm like, I'm not gonna,
yeah,
but yeah, they're a great band, and I thought the show was great, and his singing was so on point, made me quite jealous.
And he shaved his hair off in the middle, right, in the
he
interval.
Did, yeah.
That's true method acting at its finest,
he's getting
and his hair's
it.
So good as well,
yeah,
so
yeah.
That's commitment
it's a
to the art.
Risky business.
Was the British punk scene, if you want to call it that, were those bands like, say, The Damned, The Sex Pistols, The Clash, were they important to you growing up, or were you more influenced earlier on by the West Coast and East Coast American hardcore stuff?
Definitely more the American hardcore. I mean, I remember I Exploit the Troops of Tomorrow was one of the first records I got, like the punk record. But then I got really way more into like Minor Threat and Dead Kennedys and Black Flag and Bad Brains and that stuff like that. And I actually remember like when I was like, you know, 16, hearing like Sex Pistols, I'm like, oh, this is just slow.
Mm-hmm.
But
I guess if you've grown up on a diet of Minor Threat and Dead Kennedys, it's
going
to
exactly.
seem just like rock and roll, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, but then, you know, like your taste evolves and you grow. And I mean, I've been very in love with the UK like 70s punk for a very long time. But when I was a young kid in my formative years, I think that American hardcore was definitely, I mean, you know, that was definitely something that appealed to me way more. But then, you know, a lot of the
was British, that the sound? Was it the message? Was it a bit of both?
It's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like when you're a young person, you're impressionable. So a lot of the stuff, I mean, you know, I got into Youth of Today and then I'm like a straight edge kid because, you know, that whole thing. So it was all of it combined. And same thing with the Dead Kennedys. I mean, their music was amazing. But then, you know, you had the booklet with all the politics and the lyrics. And I'm just like, this is too much. It's like mind blown. And, you know, and then, as I said, later I got into you know, The Damned and The Pistols and The Clash, a huge band for me in my life. But it's the formative years. It was more New York hardcore and DC hardcore. And
heavier, you know? Shorter, yeah. Faster.
I would say that the first thing I got into as far as hardcore was actually more of the, because I was a metalhead. I was a total metalhead.
So was thrash big for you?
So thrash was huge for me.
Right.
Anthrax, Megadeth, Metallica, Slayer, Voivod, you know, that whole mm-hmm. thing was huge for me. But I wasn't really a player. I couldn't really play. So when I discovered like the crossover thing with like Crumbsuckers, Agnostic Front and DRI, that was huge. And then, you know, into like Youth of Today and Negative Approach and all that stuff. Yeah.
What about punk as a, you know, perhaps like a set of beliefs, as a, you know, kind of an ideological framework from which to launch not just a creative path, but also, you know, your personal life? How important was punk as a thing to you as a kid?
When it happened, it is to this day probably the most important thing that happened in my life. Like how it affected everything that I am and everything that I thought I knew about the world. So it was a massively, massively important thing. And it's one of those deals, like, it's hard to underestimate. Like
here comes the booze.
Yep. Hard to underestimate the, you know, the importance of something like that. Because, you know, like when you're a young person, there's a trajectory of your life and where you're supposed to go. And then it changed everything. And I mean, for me, it was like, I always thought of punk as this idea that anything is possible. But yeah, it changed everything. The way I talk, the way I dressed, everything. It was changed because of punk music.
And what about your childhood? Were you like someone who got on well at school? Were you a sociable kid? Were you a happy kid?
Nah. I mean, I think I was for the most time quite a happy kid.
Yeah.
But I was definitely a bit of a loner, and I definitely did not get along with people in my school. I mean, from an early age, I was a bit of an outsider. So I think also that's why first metal and then punk appealed to me, because like it was like outside culture, rebel culture, and I think punk for me defined a lot of my sense of alienation to the world. And then when I became a punk, I was a bit of an asshole. I was that guy, and you know, that went full mohawk and like came to class and like fuck you. You know, like I was that guy for a little bit, because
went full nihilist.
Yeah, pretty much. But I think a lot of it had to do with just the perception of yourself as an outsider, perception of yourself as like this misfit. And then discovering a music that embraced that whole identity, I was like, oh, I'm going to embrace the fact that I feel like an outsider and really kind of go for it and be like, you know, I thought I was smarter and better than everyone else because I discovered this music. And then I let the world around me know it for a while.
Well, who were the thinkers that really switched you on to, you know, a lot of the themes and the ideas which have defined your creative body of work, you know, in the kind of stance that you've taken towards issues like feminism and capitalism and things like this? Was it just music, or was there also like, you know, political thinkers and authors and other writers?
I mean, for sure, a lot of it. I mean, it all started with music. It all started with the idea that music was sort of a platform where you could, you know, speak out or say if you had something to say, music was a great platform. But I mean, I think the first thing I read was a Noam Chomsky book about like you know, the imperialism of capitalism, you know, and I was like, wow, this is insane how everything ties in together. So Chomsky was like the first for me that kind of opened my eyes to a bigger political picture. But early on, when we were punks, we were hanging out with the anarchists, like the anarchist youth group in towns. So I was hanging out with them, but it wasn't so education, it was more a nihilistic thing, actually. But then, so Chomsky was the first thing that really got me into reading about politics. And then I went through all the thinkers from, I mean, I've studied Marx, I've Bakunin, Kropotkin, all the anarchist writers, Emma Goldman, and went all the way to like the Situationist movement in France with Guy Debord and Ralph Van Eygem. You know, I've read it all. I'm like one of those kids that like, I didn't have much of an education and I kind of dropped out of school. So when I discovered politics, I made an effort to learn as much as possible about it. So I had a couple of years in the mid to late 90s, early 2000s, where I actually studied political science at home and political theory, where I had like stacks of like political thinkers by the edge of my bed. And I was reading every day for at least 2 hours every day, just these political thinkers. And you know, you read everything from Foucault to, you know,
I did a lot of Foucault at university.
Yeah. And I did that voluntarily by myself because I wanted to learn about these things. So it was an interesting journey, but that was a bit later. I mean, at first, and I think that's a cool thing about punk. At first, it was very, it's like a gut reaction to the world. And
purely visceral and emotional.
Pure
and,
visceral, yeah. Purely emotional, purely like, you know, there's something wrong. And you kind of like, and you speak out kind of uninformed, but like.
But passionate.
Passionate, yeah. And very, very honest. And then I one of the things that struck me was like, I'm doing all these interviews. I mean, this is way before social media, which is fantastic because nowadays people can't really do that. They'll get called out by leftist people who think they're better than right-wing people that think you're wrong. You know, like, so you can kind of go through these phases where you tried out these political ideas on stage or in interviews.
Well, they have to change over time, right?
Yeah.
If you're just stagnant in one belief system forever, then you're closed off, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's. But one of the things that happened to me was that I was doing interviews, I was talking to people, and then once in a while, someone came up to me and they actually challenged me for real. And I was like, whoa. And there was a lot of things that I didn't have answers to because it was all emotional, you know? So then I actually started studying, and I was like, if I'm going to be this guy that, you know, going to devote my life to talk about politics, I have to actually know what I'm talking about. And I studied it. I've studied hard. And I mean, still to this day, I read a lot of political theory. I read a lot about what's going on in the world so that you can, when people challenge you, you have an answer and you have an idea what you're actually talking about in depth, you know, not just like a slogan. I mean, a lot of our music is very sloganry, very, very like, you know, something for people to sing along to. But then behind the sloganry, there's been hours and hours and hours of discussion about these topics and hours of like, rewriting lyrics so they can fit the sort of little verse, chorus, verse, you know, trajectory.
I think what's always been so fascinating about Refused as a band as well is the music has very much been an embodiment of this radical thought that, you know, is contained within the lyrics, and the two serve each other.
Yeah.
What was the reaction when you guys started going off the cliff and experimenting from within the scene? Because traditionally, and I don't want to badmouth anyone listening to this, but I know, and you probably do too from experience better than anyone, that punk, hardcore, these scenes can be quite closed-minded sometimes when it comes to thinking outside the box and doing things differently to the, you know, the accepted way.
For sure. And I think that that's one of the things that I think we felt going into it, we refused that it was like, it's like a clean slate. You can try anything. But when we did Shape of Punk to Come, a lot of the people in the scene didn't like it. A lot of the people in the scene thought we were a bunch of pretentious fucks, which is, of course, true. You know, we were. We're very, like, highbrow. And we're very, like, okay, we're, like, intellectuals, like, in a kind of an asshole-ish way. But we made this music that we felt like, oh, this is really good. This is different. We're trying out new things. And a lot of the people in the hardcore scene were just like, oh, fuck these guys. And so when we broke up in 98, we had a sense of like, yeah, that didn't really go well. Like that record kind of flopped. And then here we are like, you know, like whatever, 21 years later and people are still, you know, we're talking about it with our management. Like, oh, no, the Shape of Punk stuff still sells the most. I'm like, oh, that's so crazy. Because when it came out, like a lot of hardcore kids didn't like it. A lot of hardcore kids were like, this is too weird. It's too pretentious. It's too political. It's, you know, whatever. And then, you know, we broke up.
Well, yeah, right, pretty much straight after the release of the album, right?
Well, no,
it wasn't long.
We actually, the European release of the record was in February, so we toured the record for 6 months. But we broke up like a week before the US release. So
right.
It's like, it's one of those deals where it's like, we're touring the States and we break up and then the record comes out and it takes off. And we're just like, oh, we're sitting at home being like, what the hell's going on with this record? You know, it's just going places. And,
The world finally caught up.
Yeah, but we did 6 months of touring. We did like two Scandinavian tours. We did two European tours. Did a bunch of festivals. So we were working on the record. And we're getting any response. Like people were just like, yeah, whatever. Like we liked their last record better. And you know, like we're coming back to cities and it's not that great. And I remember like the first tour premiere of that whole album cycle. Yeah, there's no one there, and like we had like backing tracks, but on an ADAT,
right?
And it kept fucking up, and we weren't like we hadn't practiced
because hadn't practiced it live.
Yeah, and it was a horrible thing. I remember like, oh, this is gonna be rough, you know, like.
Well, it's such an ambitious record that it must have been pretty hard you know, when you're just right there after the release of it, trying to replicate that stuff live.
Yeah.
Was it a miserable experience touring that album?
Yeah, it was.
It was.
But it wasn't so much, I mean, one of the aspects was that I think that we felt that we didn't prepare enough. But then, I mean, listening back to live stuff from 98, it sounds pretty awesome. Like there's some small glitches here and there, but it sounds pretty awesome. But the experience was miserable because we didn't like each other at that point. Like we didn't get along. And as I said, the crowd started getting smaller and smaller. And we're like, you know, we're playing this very ambitious record with mm-hmm. these very ambitious songs. And like 20 people show up and you're like, oh, this is not,
disheartening, right?
Yeah, this is not what we hoped it would be. So it was, and you know, as I said, we weren't getting along. Like everybody was kind of burnt out on touring. We were burnt out on each other. And I think everybody wanted something different with music. So yeah, it wasn't a great time. Looking back at it now, I'm like, there's some fun incidents and you know, we try to make the most of it, but it was those 6 months when the record was out and we were touring. It's just, yeah, not great.
And when it ends, does it end badly?
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah. So you think at that time, presumably, not only is the band over, but your friendships with each other are probably a thing of the past too.
Yeah, we didn't talk for a long time. Like we broke up. Me and David started the band and we broke up. And I think it was 2 years before we actually sat down and talked after we broke up, because it was like bad blood, you know, like it wasn't good. And then we sat down and talked and we're like, oh, wait, we like each other. And then, you know, that kind of faded away. And then it took us another like 6-7 years, and then we could actually start making fun of who we were back then. Mm-hmm. And then now it's like, that's like a complete laughing matter. He's always like, oh, do you remember that show when you said, and everyone's like, oh, that's insane. You know, so now it's like, you know, you have a distance to, you can joke about, and you can actually make fun of the jackass that you were, you know?
I guess that comes with being mature and older and wiser as well, right? And
hopefully
growing and learning.
Yeah.
Was there a period of time where you just didn't want any association with the band name or the music that you made? Did you feel like it was hard to come to terms and be at peace with the legacy of the band?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, especially like, I mean, I started Noise Conspiracy a week after Refuse broke up, and we started playing and we started, you know, writing music, and I was so disheartened by the whole experience, and I felt very much like, okay, so we're going to start a band that's not a part of a scene. We're going to do something completely like our own thing and not fall in with like, oh, we're a hardcore band or whatever. And we start touring and people are just like, I love Refused. Every night people are like,
can't escape
that
it.
Was a good show. I love Refused. And you're like, oh man. So for a long time, it was quite annoying that we couldn't escape it really. But then, you know, after a while you're like, I guess it's, you know, I guess it's fine. I guess it's like you soften a little bit and then you can actually look at the record and be like, it's a pretty good record.
Yeah, yeah,
you
know?
And
yeah.
Then you kind of
let to
say. That sink in, and you're like, oh, I can live with this. So, but it took a while. It took a while to really, you know, get to that place where we were fine with it, you know?
I want to ask you this. What's the seed for the, you know, the Reformation? Because assumedly you'd sort of walked away from that forever, and you were so busy during those years and doing such great stuff. One of my favorite things actually about watching Against Me live for many years was watching Inge just jump all over he's Dee Dee Ramone, isn't he? Like, he
is
the offspring of Dee Dee Ramone. So you do all this great stuff, and then assumedly you're happy and you're content in your life and everything.
Yeah.
So what's the draw to sit back down together as a group? And
there's a lot of stuff that went down that just kind of made that possible. When I mean, someone asked about that yesterday, just in the bus, and like one of our crew people, and we're like, well, there's so many little things that kind of leads you to a place. And one of the big little things was that we're all living in the same city. When we broke up, we were scattered all over the world doing different things and getting into different projects. And 2011, all of a sudden, everybody lives in the same hometown, in the same town. Me and David had a hardcore band called AC4 together.
Yep, great band.
Yeah, it was great. It's fun. And then Chris and David and Magnus had like a project. And so we're all moving in the same circles. And 2012 was a year when no one had much going on. And then we got the offer from Coachella and we're kind of playing music. You know, so it's all these little things. And then all of a sudden, you're there, you know, like, oh, yeah, maybe we should do this. And it happened, yeah.
How were those first, well, rehearsals, first of all? Did the old feelings come back fairly quick?
No, it was horrible.
Was it?
Yeah. No, not like, it was just, we were very out of shape, and I started screaming. I lost my voice in like 10 minutes. I'm like, ah, this is going to be horrible. But then, you know, you do a couple more rehearsals, and then it was fine. This is a lot of drumming going
on. This is a lot of drumming, isn't it? Let me have one check and see if it carries through into the room.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-oh.
We're locked out that way anyway.
Perfect.
We'll roll it.
What?
We'll roll it.
All right.
It doesn't make it inaudible. It's just not ideal.
It's just gouging away in the background.
Punk rock podcasting. The first show, where was that?
The first show was in Umeå at a really small place that holds maybe, say, 200 people maybe. We had a guest list of 200 people for that show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was a line outside of 500 people who wanted to get in. It's wild. It was fun. One of the things about like getting together, like the payday from Coachella was pretty good.
Yeah.
And it enabled us to like to take months off. And I mean, we practiced for 3 months, 5 days a week, 9 to 5. Just to get in shape, because we knew also the unreasonable expectations that people had, because most people never seen us live. So everyone's like, oh, we're expecting, you know, a certain thing from you.
Well, you've been mythologized to high heaven,
yeah, exactly,
right at this point.
And it's tricky to combat that myth of who you are. People, oh, you're legends. I'm like, ah, that's a lot to put on a person, you know. But it was... It gave us the chance to sort of like really do our homework and really kind of dig in and be like, what kind of band are we? How? And I mean, one of the things too, we had to change the whole being a DIY hardcore band that played in basement and coffee shops and record stores and squats to play Coachella.
Yeah.
Like, how do you make that transition without making the transition physically first? Because the last show we played was in Harrisburg, Virginia, in front of 45 people. And then, okay, next time we're going to play Coachella. So, like, we had to figure out a way where this music could work at that level.
Yeah, yeah. So and the stage show
as
well,
at
right?
A stage show. Like, how do we move? I mean, for me, it was fine because I did Noise Conspiracy and we played Coachella. And, you know, so, but it was a lot of work to sort of figure out, to maneuver this thing into a place where we felt we were comfortable enough to keep doing this, you know?
Did you feel like you'd grown as a performer and a vocalist in those intermittent years working on all these other projects
so.
As well? Did
yeah,
you feel like right now I've risen to the task and I can do this band the justice that it deserves?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
And I think that was a thing, like when we started Refused, there was a decent singer, but David was an extraordinary drummer. Like Chris, when he got into the band, he's such a good guitar player. So there's like a level of musicianship that I felt, for a long time, I felt inadequate to that. I'm like, yeah, I'm an all right singer, but I was a great frontman. So like I could kind of go crazy, and then they would cut me some slack that I was not always on pitch. And, you know, like, but then in those years, like it's 14 years of me constantly touring. Like I came and I was like, okay, we're on the level now. Like I'm a way better singer than I used to be. So that gave me a lot of confidence to believe in the fact that we could actually do this for real, you know.
And then when do you start writing new material for what would become Freedom? Is that fairly soon after getting back together and those initial run of shows? Or
not really, no. I mean, the idea was just to do a couple of shows.
That it was. Like,
yeah, it was.
And
like,
then go back to your day jobs.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Go back to doing whatever. I was doing Invasion. I just started Invasion, so that was kind of my focus. I'm like, I'm going to go back and do that. But then halfway into 2012, people were like, maybe we should do more of this. And I'm like, oh, maybe. And then you know, Chris and they asked me like once, like, we got some ideas for new songs, because they're doing a project that was like, didn't sound like Refused, but there's a similarity in the sort of there's like a proggy metal thing. Mm-hmm. Elektra is actually a song that they wrote for another project that we switched around and made something different, you know.
Right
So they had some riffs, and they were like, how do you feel about making new Refused music? And it took me completely by surprise, because I was like, oh, 2012, that's Refuse here, and then, you know, I'll go back to doing whatever, play with Invasion in front of 50 people, it'd be fine. But then they asked me, and they played me a demo version of Electra, and I'm like, oh, that's a good riff. I'm like, that's, yeah. So we did the whole 2012 thing. We took a couple of weeks, months off, and then we started writing. And then and it became fairly, like, an intense writing process for that record. And we kept it a secret. Like, we when we did the last show of 2012, it was like, oh, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. We knew, like, no, we're not, it's not over. but we had to kind of, like, do a little bit of the, you know, switch and bait so that people would leave us alone.
Throw them off the scent.
A little bit, yeah. Because it would be one of those things where people be like, oh, and you refused your record, you should do this. We didn't tell a lot of our friends even. Like, we practiced and we were writing for a couple of months before I even told the people Invasion. I'm like, I'm doing a new Refuse record. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah, we've been secretly practicing, you know? So just to be like, not interfere with other people's opinion.
Keeping it pure.
Yeah, keeping it pure. You know.
What a trip. I can't imagine there's many bands in the history of music that have been separated for that long and then have reconvened and created again after such an extended period
of
time.
Well, I think it happens. A lot of bands kind of break up for 10 years, get back together. But for us, the weird thing was that the band we were when we broke up and the band we were when we got back together were two completely different bands.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you see all these documentaries about bands of their... I mean, we're not that big of a band, but like the rise of the band, like how they get more and more popular, that happened to us without anyone in the band being involved.
Yep.
You know, so it was a weird thing where we're like, you could see our band taking off. You could see like it was creating its own legacy, and we were not on that ride. So I think that's what sets us apart from a whole lot of other bands that were like, when we got back together, we were in a completely different level. And we're like, okay, so where do we go from now? Like, how do we reconcile with the fact that we're not the band that we were 14, 15 years ago, but we're something completely different? And how do you work with that? I mean, and Freedom was us trying to figure that out. Like, where do we go with this music? And where do we go with these ideas? And then, so Freedom was that was all the whole process of trying to figure out our identity as a band, you know?
What was it like from a personal point of view, like with your brothers in that format, creating and catching up in this way that, you know, only music allows?
Yeah, it was Freedom was an intense experience. We practiced a lot. It was really, it was difficult because there was a lot of pressure, especially from ourselves. It's like one of those deals, I think also we knew early on that it was like one of those deals where I think we could pass like gold flakes to people and they'll still be like, eh, it's not the shape of punk to come. Because when you have a record that you live with for that long, it does. I mean, we can create a record that's 10 times better and people will still not have that emotional connect to it.
Well, so that's half of music, isn't it?
It is. And we were talking about that today. And Chris said, we can't fucking recreate people's childhood for them.
Yeah.
So when
that is magic.
That is magic. And that is the magic. Someone came up to me last night and they were like, I was 13 years old. I was into Korn and Limp Bizkit. I heard Refuse New Noise. It blew my mind. I'm like, I mean, no matter how good the music we create is going to be, we're never going to blow that guy's mind again in that way. And especially when you live with the record for like 15, 16 years, and I'm like, I hear some new music, you know? And so it was a tough process. I think that record is great. I think it has a couple of really cool songs on it. I think it's a bold and daring record. I understand that it's not the record that a lot of people were expecting us to put out. But that's also part of the process of being an artist. Like, you have to be like, what do we need to do to move on? And then now with War Music, I think this makes complete sense. You know, this is us. Without Freedom, there wouldn't be War Music. So this is us like trying to find, like, we did Freedom and we're like, okay, this makes sense. And then, you know, here we are. And super exciting record and super excited about like just moving forward.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, every album, I think, if not is, should be a reaction to the last and a reaction to the now.
Yes.
And what's going on.
Hegel for you. Hegelian dialectics, as I've studied.
And the recording process of this one, how did that differ from Freedom? What made this record's kind of creation unique?
Well, Freedom, we went to L.A. We recorded with a guy called Nick Launay. It's an amazing character. He did like the last 6 Nick Cave records, 7 Nick Cave records.
Wow.
And he worked with the Yeah Yeahs, and he did the new, he's doing the new Idols record and Anna Calvi, you know. So we went with him, and we went to LA, and we rented a house, and we were in LA for 6 weeks. Like, really, we practiced so much before we came to LA. And this record, we went to a studio on an island in Sweden. And then we recorded in 5 different studios outside of Stockholm, in Stockholm, with friends. David and Chris produced the record. A lot of it, we didn't practice a lot. It was a lot of it like demos, but trying to capture like the rawness of like how we want this to sound live. So it was a completely different process. And this record took a very long time to create, because it was like a patchwork. It was like, we'll have a weekend here, we'll do some, you know, we'll do some vocals over that weekend. I'll come down to Stockholm for a day, we do some stuff. And then, so it's a very different sort of more, very much like a homegrown type of record.
Because it sounds like a homecoming experiment.
Yeah. And that's what it feels like. It feels like one of those things where we're like, we really did this ourselves. All the people that worked on the record are friends of ours, people that we've known forever, that we just like, do you want to record some vocals? Yeah, I'll record some vocals. You know, so it's very, in that unassuming and unpretentious, but really aiming high at the same time. So yeah, it's a very different process than going to LA and working with a big producer and, you know, doing that whole thing. So
was it fun to do that, though? Because presumably you wouldn't have got to do that with Refused, at least last time around.
No, not at all. But yeah, I like that process. I've done a couple. I mean, I did some records with Rick Rubin.
I was going to ask you next about Conspiracy. Working with him. Yeah.
So it's like I've done a couple of those things, and I find it interesting because it's a very different process from a lot of records you do it yourself. It's a very kind of internal affair. And I like it when someone comes from the outside and be like, oh, this is how we should tweak it. But, you know, like, it is one of those things, you have to balance it out, because at the end of the day, no one knows Refused better than Refused. So how do you, like, you know, so it's very different things. But I enjoyed working with Nick Launay. We're very good friends still, and we're very, like, I really liked him. Maybe not the best fit for our band, but that's something you learn, you know, like you try something, you're like, yeah, it was fine. You know, I think the record sounds great. So actually it sounds great.
What about Rick Rubin? Tell me about that guy, what he brings to the Rick, equation.
Yeah. Rick Rubin was the guy that taught me how to sing. He punished me quite a lot on the singing front.
That's interesting, because I've heard from a lot of people that he's not a hands-on producer.
He was insanely well. We did 2 records with Rick. First one, Armed Love, he was super hands-on. He was in the studio every day. I did 6 weeks of vocals with him. 6 weeks, just vocals. Every day, me and him and an engineer. some days we did vocals for 7 hours, some days we did vocals for 20 minutes, and he's like, oh, you sound tired, just go home. And he was very particular about how he wanted me to sing. And I came out of that process 10 times better singer. And then the next time we came back, he showed up once in a while, he left some notes, and he was like, oh, it's fine.
Because he felt, I guess, like he'd got you to a place.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's...
Where he could leave you unsupervised.
Exactly. And also he... The people he surrounds himself with are engineers that they know. I mean, we were doing overdubs and someone's like, well, we'll do this. And the engineer just looked at us. He's like, no, Rick's not going to like that. We're like, all right, let's not do that. So, but yeah, it was a very different... He was not hands-on at all the second time. The first time he was super hands-on. But I mean, he, as I said, that experience of being in Sound City with like the best engineer, the best producer, like it's something you'll remember for the rest of your life, you know. It's a truly amazing experience. I wish those records would have done better, but that's a part of life too, you know. Like it happened, and I learned so much from those records and learned so much from that experience that it's amazing, you know.
Do you remain optimistic, Dennis, about the future of our world? To segue gently into that.
Well, on most days, yes, I do. I think that there's a power in us that can transcend the mundane madness of what goes on around us. I mean, to a certain extent, the world looks kind of fucked, but I still believe in us. I still believe that people can do good. I still believe that people want to do good. So yeah, without that feeling, it would be impossible to get up on stage and I talk about like radical ideas or radical change and so on. So I have to believe. But then yeah, some days you're like, oh, it's too much. Mm. There's too much going on. But that I guess that's a part of what's happening. I mean, with what's going on now with the whole environmental movement and Greta Thunberg, it's amazing. It's such an inspiration.
She's like a modern day Martin Luther King or something, isn't she? Yeah, she feels like that kind of figure in the world.
She's amazing. So that gives you hope, that gives you inspiration, that you know, look at young kids and you're like, if young kids can do that, like then maybe the world will become a better place. I mean, just look, I saw some...
Are you a parent?
No, I'm not. I have a partner that very much wants me to be a parent, so you know.
Perhaps
it will happen in soon. The cards, yeah. But I mean, the same thing. I saw like an electoral map of America, and it was like, I think there were 3 states that were Republican if young kids get to vote. So there's definitely, I mean, there's a generation of which rich, white, privileged men that are dying out, which is a good thing. So I think I'm quite, if the planet in itself can survive, I think there is hope for the future.
I think it's almost like I guess every period in time that happens, the people living through it feel that way. But I feel like this moment in time is, as well as being the most terrifying, also the most exciting and significant period of potential change or catastrophe.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. Like everything feels perhaps more vital now than ever before, not just in terms of environmentalism, but politics as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's never... I don't think the world has ever been this divided.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, a tool to keep people sort of at each other's throat, and instead of seeing kind of the real problems and seeing what the real issues are. But we made huge strides in feminism, huge strides in environmental thinking. I mean, I've been vegan for 26 years. It's the best time of my life to be vegan.
How easy is it to be a vegan now?
It's so easy.
Even on tour.
It's not even a challenge anymore. So we made some great strides. We made some great progress, but then there's other parts where we're actually slipping, and it's actually worse. I mean, the economical divide is getting bigger and bigger again, especially in the West world. I mean, the economic divide is shrinking in Southeast Asia a little bit. People are rising out of poverty, but in the West, it's actually increasing again. And the 1% is like, you know, like, it is the reason why they're called the 1%. So there are definitely things that are worse, definitely things that are better, but it's also interesting to see where that will lead us, you know?
I think technology is a trip in today's world, because the irony of technology is that it's designed and invented to bring people together and increase communication. And I do feel like it's having the opposite. Right? Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Is that the way you see it? There's obviously many, many beautiful things that the internet affords us, freedom of information. And but I do feel like the interconnectivity of the human race is, you know, dissipating at a rate that's quite alarming and scary.
I think the political discourse has corroded because of the fact that people communicate on platforms like Twitter and Instagram, and the way we communicate there is very
black and white.
Yeah, black and white, completely without depth, completely without like any shades of you know, the complexities of most of these issues. And it's also become like a battleground for, especially for the right wing. And they're pretty good at it because they have no scruples. They have plenty of fake accounts, and they can attack people over and over again and make it seem like there are way more people who think a certain way than there actually are. So it's a tricky thing because it's like it is very divisive and it's very anti-intellectual, I must say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, discourse is almost discouraged.
Exactly.
Isn't it,
yeah, yeah. And you don't want people to actually have some sort of analysis of the actual political conversation or political situation, because the conversation can't hold that. So it's a bit weird, and it's a bit weird seeing, like, I mean, even on our social media where people's critique of our band is, and I'm like, there's plenty of stuff to critique a band for, and especially a band like ours, but I feel like almost all of the critique against our band is, I'm like, that's just uninformed. It's not, you know, proper critique. So it's a bit weird, and it's, so as you said, it's very black and white, and it's very like, I mean, I was the guy, kind of guy that I had a study circle where I studied the Das Kapital with Karl Marx because I wanted to learn about politics. And now people get a lot of their political opinions from Twitter and from like fake news, or they read the headlines, and then that's news, it. You know.
And it's all very clickbaity, isn't it?
Yeah,
because these sites just want those.
Yeah,
clicks.
Exactly. So it's of course tricky when there is no real depth of analysis to it. And then that's also why I tend to not interact in these conversations, because I was like, there's no point in me getting into this, because I mean, if someone has an issue with something that I've said, come up and talk to me. We can hash it out.
Yeah,
I'm sure we can find some common ground. And it's also, I mean, one of the things I have to admit too is like, when you are in a band and when you are an artist performing, our whole agenda is to dial it up to 11 and to be abrasive and to
provocative,
be confrontational and provocative, because it doesn't make for exciting art to go, well, on the one hand.
That's what live debates are for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is, if you sit down like this, you can sort of cover all the areas. But when I got like 30 seconds on stage to say something about the state of the world.
You want to get in people's face and make them think, right?
Exactly. You can't go, on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, you have to kind of be the asshole about it. And I think that's the same thing with our lyrics. Where they're quite explicit. They're quite like in your face, because that's what we need. And also, one thing that me and David talked a lot about when writing these lyrics is that in a world that's so not radical right now, because, I mean, even the left spectrum is so far to the center that it's not discernible as the left anymore, especially in Sweden. It's very... But our thing has always been, like, if there wasn't for Malcolm X, no one would listen to Martin Luther King. So we gladly be Malcolm X.
Yeah.
And then someone that's a bit more reasonable can sort of...
A bit more center,
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's fine. And that is art, you know. That's why we have art, to sort of exaggerate and to go across the line and to be provocative. And then you can end up somewhere else. I mean, if you dial it up to 11, maybe we'll end up at 6. We'd be fine, you know.
What an exciting time to be in a band like Refused, and to be on stage, and to be traveling the world. I think, you know, I've done a lot of tours, and the beauty for me of being on the road and making a living through touring is you get to see that there isn't actually as much difference as the news would have us believe.
Yeah.
You know, from city to city, from country to country, from continent to continent. You break down those barriers. Obviously, you're in the ultimate profession which does that, musically.
Yeah.
And you see that human beings are pretty much one and the same, right? Yeah. Our wants, hopes, and goals are fairly...
We all would just want to get along with our lives and do good and be good. I mean, that's what more people want. And then some people are uneducated and some people are miseducated in what they think the problems are and so on. But I mean, most people just kind of want to get along with their lives and live lives and have their friends and families and listen to music. And, you know, that's just what most people want. They're just going to get on with it, you know? And as you said, we get told that we're so different and we can never, you know, bridge this gap. But I think that, as I said earlier on, I think one of the things that this gap and this divide is here for a reason, to make sure that we can't, you know, if we attack each other, we're not going to hold capitalism as an idea accountable, because it's hard, because capitalism has no center. It's just like a very abstract sort of notion, like a social constructal, you know, like it's a mathematical sort of equation almost. And for a lot of people, it's hard to hold that accountable and to see that that's a real problem. And then like, well, this guy just came to the country, so maybe he's the problem. And at the end of the day, most people just want to live a great life. And I think that one of the problems with capitalism as an idea is that it can't provide that for people anymore. I don't think it ever...
It takes care, as you said earlier, of those ones at the top, and it forgets about everybody else.
And I think, I don't think capitalism ever really... has been able to take care of people. We in the West has been privileged because we've used the rest of the world as our own resource. Exploitation, you know, like, so we've had it pretty good, but then now it's starting to catch up with us as well. And you know, we're plagued with mental illness. We're plagued with people feeling like shit in this world. I think it is because we live in an unsustainable system, and that pushes too much pressure on people. People work double jobs. City like London, you can't afford to live anywhere in the city because it's so fucking expensive. And it just puts this massive pressure on people to succeed in a game that's stacked against you, you know?
Well, on that note,
yes,
of optimism and triumph and drums.
Drums.
We will leave
drums.
It there, dude. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
A really great chat.
That was
and
good times.
Next time you're over, we'll do one again when we've got a bit more time to play with and go all over the place. But thank you for the music. Thanks for a great talk.
Thank you.
And good luck. What's the plans for next year for you guys?
Touring. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you'll be back in the UK soon, no doubt.
Yes. Yes, we will.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Cheers, dude.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.